Mr. Samuel Blumenfeld, who will speak to us on the subject, the struggle for educational freedom.
Thank you, Dr. Jones, so very much. It's a great pleasure to be here at Bob Jones University for so many reasons. But for me, especially since I'm a recent comer to the fold, in a sense. I am now a completed Jew. I was born a Jew in 1926, and I had to wait 58 years before I realized that Jesus Christ is the Jewish Messiah. It took a little time, but I finally got there. It actually began some years ago when I was doing research for my earlier book, Is Public Education Necessary? And I had to read John Calvin's The Institutes of the Christian Religion. I had to read that book because I wanted to find out what it was that the Unitarians were objecting to. And that book was a great revelation to me. It certainly convinced me that Christ had been sent to extend the covenant, which had been made with Abraham, the covenant to the rest of the world, to the Gentile. And so it made great sense to me that Christ was indeed the Jewish Messiah, and that his mission was the most important mission that the Messiah could have, to save mankind, to save us all from sin and the consequences of sin. So it gives me great pleasure, of course, to be among you, because I certainly feel very much at home here. It is a pleasure and a privilege to address this convocation at Bob Jones University, this great symbol and bastion of educational freedom in America. Government-owned and operated schools, colleges, and universities are so prevalent in America that most of our people have lost sight of the meaning of educational freedom and of its importance to the continued existence of this country as a free, independent nation. Which brings me to the National Education Association. Some of you are probably wondering why you should be concerned with that rather obnoxious teachers' union. Well, if you care about the future of educational freedom in this country, then you have to be concerned with what the NEA is doing to curtail that freedom. The simple fact is that the NEA has a political and social agenda which, if carried out to its ultimate fulfillment, will mean the end of our Judeo-Christian civilization. The NEA is not what the public or even most teachers perceive it to be. It is, in reality, a political organization that uses education as its means of attaining its primary political ends. It's been that way since World War I, when the progressives took over the NEA and transformed it into a large membership organization. The progressives were determined to use public education as the means of changing America from a free enterprise, individualistic, and religious nation into a socialist, collectivist, and atheist society. But in order to implement their program in the schools, they knew that they would need the cooperation of America's teachers and superintendents. And that is why they took control of the NEA and still control it to this day. But it wasn't until the NEA became a full-fledged labor union in the mid-60s that the NEA decided to pull out all stoppers in its political activities. In 1967, NEA Executive Secretary Sam Lambert proclaimed, quote, NEA will become a political power second to no other special interest group. NEA will organize this profession from top to bottom into logical operational units that can move swiftly and effectively and with power unmatched by any other organized group in the nation, unquote. In November 1969, the NEA's monthly magazine, Today's Education, boldly stated, quote, "The NEA is not content to wait for something to happen. It is making things happen. The profession now has massive resources at its command. The job ahead is one of mobilizing and directing these resources with precision and purpose," unquote. In 1974, NEA President Helen Wise said, quote, "Teachers individually and collectively can change the direction of government," unquote. And in 1975, NEA President John Ryer stated, quote, "We must become the foremost political power in the nation," unquote. Why this obsession with political power? And in what direction does the NEA want to take our government? Leftward, of course. The NEA makes no secret of what it wants. You can read their entire blueprint for social and political change, given in great detail each year in the form of resolutions adopted at their annual convention. In many respects, it resembles the platform of a political party. For these resolutions become legislative proposals to be pushed by the NEA's national and state lobbies. But since the enactment of legislation depends on getting legislators to vote the way you want them to vote, the NEA now concentrates heavily on getting its yes men elected. And they have the wherewithal to do so, which accounts for their great success. Local organizations in over 12,000 school districts, powerful organizations in each state, 1,170 full-time, highly trained field organizers, which the Reader's Digest called the largest grassroots political army ever deployed in the United States, a powerful lobby in Congress, and an annual cash flow of about $500 million. No political party in America has that kind of resources. Such an unprecedented concentration of power makes the NEA the most politically dangerous organization in America, particularly since its members are all public employees. Its resolutions for 1984-85 cover every aspect of American life, from the Equal Rights Amendment to foreign policy in Central America, from abortion on demand to a nuclear freeze. Its stand on most issues is virtually identical with that of the radical left. In fact, the NEA seems to have become the main channel through which the radical left is now exercising its political influence. In July 1981, Robert Moyer, a reporter for the Daily World, the official newspaper of the Communist Party, USA, made the following observations after attending the NEA convention. Quote, "Nowhere in the basic documents of NEA, in their resolutions or new business items, are there any anti-Soviet or anti-socialist positions. It seems unlikely that the path NEA is now taking will be reversed," unquote. Apparently, the communists are very pleased with what the NEA is doing. Its resolution on Nicaragua must be music to Gorbachev's ears. It states, quote, "The National Education Association urges the United States government to refrain from any U.S. plan for overt or covert action that would destabilize Nicaragua or would adversely affect that government's successful campaign against illiteracy," unquote. In other words, the NEA prefers the Sandinista communists to the freedom fighters who are trying to restore democracy to that country. As for Nicaragua's campaign against illiteracy, here's what the socialist publication Monthly Review writes in its July-August 1985 issue. Quote, "The 1980 literacy crusade in Nicaragua, continuing now as the adult education program, is a political program with an educational format and educational outcomes. The goal of this campaign and other mass organizational activities is to secure the revolutionary process and develop the Nicaraguan people and society through democratic participation. In no part of the world is there neutral education. Here it is not neutral, but in the interest of the working class, so that children and adults will want this revolution and will work for this revolution." Unquote. In other words, the campaign against illiteracy in Nicaragua is being used to consolidate a communist regime in Central America. And this is what the NEA is backing. Incidentally, the Sandinistas, with the help of the Cubans, are running drugs into the United States to raise cash for themselves and help destroy American youth. But the article is right when it says that there is no such thing as neutral education. The communists know it. The NEA knows it. But do the American people know it? American public schools are anything but neutral. At one time, they reflected the Judeo-Christian value system of our culture. Today, they have become temples of atheism, behaviorism, and humanism. The Christian religion has been virtually eradicated in our public schools, despite the fact that most of the students and teachers are nominally Christian. The Ten Commandments have been removed from the walls of the schools of Kentucky. Benedictions at high school graduations have been eliminated in Iowa. And in Texas, the teaching of creationism has been barred. In an exhaustive study of the public school textbooks, recently completed by Professor Paul Witz of New York University, we learn that not a single one of the 40 social studies books examined had one word of text that referred to any religious activity representative of contemporary American life. In other words, you don't exist as far as the public school textbooks are concerned. In addition, Dr. Witz analyzed over 600 stories in popular readers used in grades 3 and 6. Not one story had a religious or spiritual theme as central to the story or characters in it. The word God didn't even occur in any of the stories. Thus, the eradication of Christianity from the public school is virtually complete. Whatever is taught in a public school of a Christian nature is now done so without official approval and is considered illegal. It should be noted, however, that the attack against religion in public education is limited only to an attack on the religion of the Old and New Testaments. The latter has been replaced by the secular religion of humanism, which now dominates public education. Also, Eastern paganism is welcome in the public school. According to Liberty Magazine of September 1982, Eastern religious mysticism and prayer forms are being introduced gradually and subtly into many public schools. Meditation techniques based on Hindu pantheism are being used in many first grade classrooms across the nation, and parents are only dimly aware of what is going on. The simple truth is that public education is now not only atheistic in spirit and content, but anti-Christian. Children in the public schools are subjected to values clarification, sensitivity training, sex education, death education, globalism, pornography, foul language, blasphemy, socialism, and Eastern paganism. And most of the children attending these schools come from Christian homes. And most of the money used to promote these satanic doctrines come from Christian taxpayers. Incidentally, the NEA opposes equal access, which simply gives Christians the right to hold extracurricular activities on school property after hours. Meanwhile, many thousands of Christian parents have taken their children out of the public schools and put them into church schools or are educating them at home. Fortunately, we still have the freedom to do so. But it is a freedom that is slowly being taken from us. Our nation still acknowledges the right of private schools to exist, but the humanists don't like the fact that so many children have escaped their satanic influence. So they have gotten our legislatures to pass laws regulating private schools, including church schools. These regulations require private and church schools to teach a state-approved curriculum and to hire state-certified teachers, thus severely curtailing the freedom of private education. But since the state educators have spent the last few decades eradicating Christianity from public instruction, how can Christians consider them competent to approve a church school curriculum? And how can certified teachers trained in secular anti-Christian state colleges of education be considered competent to teach in Christian schools? Also, what about the much vaunted separation of church and state? If the Christian religion is not permitted in a state school because of the prohibition against mixing the state with religion, how can the state then justify regulating a church school, thereby mixing itself with religion? Apparently, our state officials have not read the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Is not a church school a function of religion? And if so, is it not therefore exempt from state regulation? But what seems so evident to you and me is apparently not so evident to our state educators, legislators, and judges. In Louisville, Nebraska, in 1981, the Faith Baptist Church and its school were padlocked, and its minister, Reverend Everett Sullivan, put in jail by state authorities for refusing to bow down to state regulation. In 1983, seven fathers of children in that school were jailed on similar charges. What was their crime? Insisting that the Constitution guaranteed them freedom of religion and thereby freedom from government regulation of their church school. You would have thought that such tyranny could never take place in a state as conservative and Christian as Nebraska. But it did. In fact, most of the Christians in that state thought that Reverend Sullivan was just being a big nuisance. Why was he making such a fuss over state regulation? Most of the Christian schools in Nebraska had accepted state regulation, even though the Constitution said they didn't have to. Then why did they do it? The answer is either cowardice, laziness, or ignorance, or perhaps all three. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, the Bible tells us. And most of the Christians of Nebraska gladly and willingly put on the shackles of state control. And those who resisted, who defended religious freedom, and believed, as Peter did, that we ought to obey God rather than men, were put in jail. In 1984, the legislature of Nebraska, embarrassed by the stubborn, unyielding resistance of Reverend Sullivan and his people, passed a new law exempting non-approved Christian schools from regulation, but requiring parents who put their children in such schools to report to the state. Not much of an improvement over the old law, but it permitted the church school to function freely. Recently also, the court in Nebraska threw out the charges against Reverend Sullivan. He is now a free man. In fact, he is now running for governor of Nebraska, which will provide much interesting copy for the media. Reverend Sullivan proved that when we obey God rather than men, we win. But what kind of a victory did Reverend Sullivan win? Merely a begrudging admission on the part of the state of Nebraska that the First Amendment exists. However, elsewhere in America, the unalienable rights of Christian parents have been grossly violated. In Idaho, six Christian parents, the Shippey brothers and their wives, were jailed and had their children taken from them because they were educating them at home without state supervision. In Alabama, Christian parents were jailed on similar charges. In both cases, the children were being loved, well cared for, and well instructed by truly concerned parents. What the state didn't like was the fact that these children were escaping state control of their young lives. Whatever happened to the parents' unalienable right to educate their children at home without interference from the state? Our founding fathers had that right, even under the tyranny of George III. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and many other founders of this country were the products of homeschooling. In fact, prior to the passage of the first compulsory school attendance law in Massachusetts in 1850, all parents were free to educate their children at home without interference from the state. Did parents give up that unalienable right when the compulsory school attendance laws were enacted? The truth is that you cannot destroy an unalienable right because such rights are derived from our Creator. The right may be taken from you by force, or you may choose not to assert it, but its origin is quite clearly stated in our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our founding fathers considered the concept of unalienable rights to be self-evident, but rather than rely on self-evidence alone, because they knew of the sinful nature of man, he couldn't be trusted, the founding fathers codified these rights in our Constitution. Today you have to go to the Supreme Court to certify their existence. The Declaration further states, quote, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, unquote. In other words, the sole purpose of government is to secure the unalienable rights of its citizens, not to take them away, not to annul them, not to prevent the citizens from exercising them, but to secure them, to make sure that the citizens can exercise them. But these rights are being stripped from our citizens every day by government bureaucrats, tax collectors, state education officials, and the courts. In the case of the homeschoolers, their rights are being threatened by the National Education Association, which is urging the state legislatures of America to crack down on homeschooling and put it under strict state regulation and control. Since 90% of the homeschoolers are devout Christians, acting out of religious conviction, are not the state regulations in violation of these parents' First Amendment rights? But in order to understand why our unalienable rights are in such jeopardy, it is necessary to understand that America is in the midst of a titanic spiritual struggle between the forces of Satan and the forces of God, between the forces of atheistic totalitarianism and the forces of Christian freedom, and that the actions by humanists against Christianity in the schools and against homeschooling parents are merely a part of that overall struggle. In fact, education is the major battlefield in which the struggle between atheistic humanism and our Judeo-Christian religious values is being fought. And that is why Christians dare not lose the battle for educational freedom. For educational freedom has become synonymous with Christian freedom. And on the outcome of that battle hinges total victory or defeat. Remember, the humanists do not believe in the existence of a creator, and therefore they do not believe in such things as unalienable rights. Incidentally, to give you an idea of the increased intensity of the attack on Christianity by the humanists, consider these statistics from the Christian Law Association. In 1972, there were no lawsuits initiated against Christian believers regarding matters of Christian faith. In 1976, there were 44 individuals involved in such cases in the U.S. In 1980, the CLA had files on 2,100 initial complaints on issues of Christian faith. In 1982, the number of cases was over 4,000. The Christian church schools are bearing the brunt of the attack by revenue agents, planning commissions, safety and health inspectors, state departments of education, and local school boards. Although most Christians seem willing to turn their children over to the humanists for brainwashing and indoctrination, the schools call it education, of course, they do not understand the dire consequences of their actions. They do not realize that a defeat of Christianity will mean the persecution and eventual extermination of Christians. Remember, the humanists have already exterminated over 16 million unborn American children and are fighting tooth and nail to retain the right to kill millions more. Do you think they will have any qualms about exterminating you when the time comes to do so, if and when you have delivered yourselves into their hands? That is why Christians must devise a strategy for victory. We really have no choice if we are to remain true to our calling. The Lord has told us to actively preach the gospel, not to accept the chains and gags of the humanists. Therefore, to remain passive is to betray our Savior. But, you might say, Christians make up the majority in this country, and the atheist humanists represent a small minority in actual numbers. How can they possibly defeat us? Well, my answer is to study history and find out how a small number of communists were able to take over all of Russia in 1917. Or to look at Poland, where 95% of the people are devout Catholics but are ruled by an atheist totalitarian government run by 5%. Our enemies follow Satan's rules of behavior. They lie, they deceive, they cheat, they murder. Remember, the Supreme Court, which ruled against Bob Jones University, is the same court that believes that it is perfectly legal and moral to murder 1.5 million unborn babies a year in America. Do you really believe that justice is possible from a court with so much blood on its hands? The United States Supreme Court has already allowed the extermination of 16 million unborn American children. Do you believe it has a Christian conscience? The humanists, of course, insist that these 16 million babies are not human. And they don't want you to consider them human. For example, the Review of the News of September 11, 1985, reported the following gruesome story. Quote, the County Board of Supervisors of Los Angeles agreed, after 3 years of controversy, to permit the burial of the remains of 16,500 aborted babies found in a storage container at the home of a man who ran a medical laboratory. When the victims of abortion were discovered in 1982, pro-life groups asked for permission to bury them, and President Reagan voiced his support for a memorial service for these children. But the Southern California chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, representing the feminist Women's Health Center, argued that the babies were unwanted biological tissue and not human, and that a religious burial service would be a violation of the separation of church and state. The California Supreme Court eventually agreed with the Feminist Center. The U.S. Supreme Court let that ruling stand last March, and Supreme Court Judge Robert O'Brien decided last month that Los Angeles County could authorize burial as long as there was no religious ceremony. Unquote. Think of it. 16,500 dead babies in plastic containers being held in storage for 3 years because the humanists refused to let Christians say a prayer at their burial. Does this not give you an idea to what lengths the humanists will go to deny the existence of God, to deny humanity to the unborn? The humanists' hatred of God is so deep that it perverts their entire view of reality. Yet the humanists now control all of American public education. They write the textbooks, conceive the programs with one goal only: to pervert the minds of our youth, to turn them away from God, and to deliver them into the hands of Satan. These are the realities that young Christians must face today about their own nation, their educators, their judges, their physicians, their lawmakers. In a spiritual struggle of this magnitude, in which the fate of our nation is at stake, you cannot be neutral or indifferent, for your very lives hang in the balance. Thus, the problem for Christians boils down to one overriding task: devising a strategy for victory. We must all remember General MacArthur's famous dictum, "There is no substitute for victory." He knew that accepting less than victory merely delayed the day of reckoning, in which victory would be much more costly and the consequences of defeat far more devastating. The first lesson in strategy is to know your enemy. You must know his state of mind, his resources, his methods of combat. The humanist is motivated by a seething, unmitigated hatred of God. His strongest resources are the great universities, the public schools of America, wealthy foundations, the media. His methods of combat are political usurpation, endless litigation, the smear, character assassination, slick distortion and deception, moral corruption, bureaucratic harassment, and so on. The key, however, to the whole humanist power structure is the public school. It's what keeps all of the graduate schools of education, all of the behavioral psychologists, sex educators, death educators, value clarifiers, sensitivity trainers, psycholinguists, and change agents in business. But it is also potentially the weakest link in the humanist fortress. I visited Israel recently, where one can see the ruins of many ancient fortress cities. In those days of old, it was known that the most effective way of conquering a fortress city was to find and eventually attack its most vulnerable point. Public education is the weakest point in the humanist fortress because it is largely supported by Christian citizens who are quite dissatisfied with the performance of our schools. True, the system is built on a strong foundation of laws that force our citizens to pay for it. But there is one thing the public schools cannot do without, and that is the children. Without the children, the system would collapse, and that would begin the unraveling of the entire humanist stranglehold of our culture. That is why the humanists are so concerned with the growth of Christian schools and homeschooling. They very clearly see the potential threat to their entire power structure. But you may be one of those who believes that Christian teachers and students should stay in the public schools to witness to unbelievers, to save souls. It's a noble intention, but by doing so, you are also supporting those who are doing all in their power to destroy Christianity. You are tithing to Satan. Or you may still be one of those who sincerely believes that public education can be reformed by way of a prayer amendment. Do you really believe that a minute of silent prayer is going to counteract 5 hours and 59 minutes given to the devil? If I thought that public education could be saved, I would say so. But the real question is, should we want to save it? The simple truth is that a government school can never serve the goals and purposes of Christian education. Christian education demands much more than a minute of silent prayer, much more than a mere acknowledgement that God exists. It demands a complete surrender to Christ, and the public school won't even let Christ in the door. What good is a school to Christians where Christ is kept out? What an insult to our Lord to put a Christian child in such a school. The only way out of this no-win situation is the massive exodus of Christian children from the public schools and the creation of Christian institutions to accommodate them. We need more Christian schools, more Christian colleges and universities, more Christian academies for the training of teachers. We need more Christian newspapers and magazines, more Christian radio and television stations. And only Christians can build these institutions. The humanists will not build them for us. But as long as we channel our resources to the humanists, they can laugh all the way to the bank. Which brings me to make this point about Christian support of public education. We all acknowledge that whatever else public education may be, it is without doubt atheistic. It was made that way by Madeleine Murray O'Hare, the atheist who did not want her son to be subjected in public school to anything remotely connected with religion. She took her case to the Supreme Court, which of course ruled on June 17, 1963, in her favor. So for all practical purposes, on that date, the public schools of America became officially atheist schools. Now I ask you, is it fair for Christians to be forced to support atheist education with their taxes? Of course, if a Christian sends his child to a public school, he has no choice but to support it. But if he doesn't and objects to the atheist content of public education, why should he be required to support it financially? Atheists are not required to support Christian education, so why should Christians be required to support atheist education? I think it's about time that Christians took their case to court and argued that forcing a Christian to support atheist education is patently unconstitutional, a serious violation of religious freedom. I also think that it is wrong for atheist education to be the sole recipient and beneficiary of public funding. Atheists should pay for their education just as Christians pay for theirs. And that is another argument against government education. There is no such thing as a value-neutral education. Values are involved the moment you start selecting textbooks or devising course content. And so values are taught in American public schools. But whose values are they? They are the values of the atheist secular religion of humanism. But when Christians complain about this, they are accused of advocating censorship. Without Christian support, the atheist public schools would not have our children to brainwash, and their days would be numbered. It is ironic that public schools were started by the Calvinists in America in colonial times to make sure that children got a religious education. Today, the public schools make sure that they don't. The Christians of America cannot ignore this fact and still call themselves Christian. They cannot blindly hand their children over to the agents of Satan and pretend that they are doing the Christian thing. The children are the ones to suffer. They are the ones who become functionally illiterate and learning disabled, go on drugs, get sexually involved, join satanic cults, or commit suicide. Last year, 6,000 teenagers in America committed suicide. Why? Because they were told that they were animals, that there is no God, that life is meaningless, and that all they have to look forward to is nuclear annihilation. The Bible tells us in 2 Corinthians what we must do. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord. You are the Christian teachers and ministers of tomorrow. You are the future leaders of America's churches, the builders of tomorrow's Christian schools. You are the shepherds of tomorrow's flocks. Lead them to salvation, not perdition. Ready them for Christ's second coming. The Lord will want to know what you did to save his children. Thank you.